session number 20513, Reel 2.
Admiral Whetstone, Reel 2.
And we learned quite a bit about ship handling, and the captain used to allow me to take over as officer of the watch when we brought the ship into wind to fly off, which was quite exciting business, because as soon as the wind across the flight deck was in the right direction and speed, then off went the planes with a great roar of power, and one hoped that these young pilots were going to get up there successfully.
How did you like being in a carrier after a battleship?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. I mean, because we were busy doing this training, and we also paid a visit to Oslo, which was fun. We were only there for 3 months, so it was a very short period, but I enjoyed it. And we had a very happy gun room, which was the midshipman's mess, largely from the Commonwealth. We had two Englishmen, a New Zealander, and I think 8 Canadians. So we were an interesting mix.
How does a gun room differ from a wardroom? Apart from the
fact, a bit less formal, less posh. I mean, we were only allowed to drink sherry and beer. Had restricted wine bills. We had a sub-lieutenant who was in charge. He was the sub-lieutenant of the gunroom, they called him. But we ran our own mess, and I suppose it was where we could learn the habits of living in an officer's mess without getting under the feet of our seniors.
So you were only in Implacable about 3 months?
For about 3 months. And then to complete my midshipman's time, we did the standard procedure. We went our small ship time, and I went to a frigate in Londonderry, the 4th Escort Group, which was again, a valuable period of time for me. We used to carry out exercises to train people who were on courses at the anti-submarine school in Londonderry, both REF and Navy. And at that time, in a small ship, one tended to have a bit more responsibility. So I think it was another stage in my development. It was then I met an officer who took me under his wing. He was our second lieutenant, and he was an ex-rating, an ex-submariner who had been with Captain Hunt in the Mediterranean. And I think he perhaps put the first idea into my head that I might become a submarine officer.
Which frigate was that?
It was the Loch Fada.
How do you spell Fada?
F-A-D-A.
Why did the idea of going into submarines interest you?
I think basically the main one is that it offered the chance of responsibility of a command at an early age. Added to which, there is something a bit, I think, special about submarines. I think people either like them or they perhaps don't understand them. But I found the idea of these vessels with a small crew and the chance of early command very exciting. It was while I was in the Loch Fada that I was allowed a day at sea in a submarine, which very impressed me, because even at that age I was able to understand that here was a very relaxed but very disciplined outfit, and one that I felt I wanted to belong in.
So did you then start taking steps?
One then could not do much about it except file it away in the bring-up section of one's brain. Because we then were promoted sub-lieutenant, and I went to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich for the junior officer's war course for 8 months, and followed by the best part of a year in Portsmouth doing what they call the sub-lieutenant's professional technical courses. At Greenwich, we were given a general education, enough physics so that we could understand the equipment we'd have to work with, naval history, British constitutional history, and writing staff papers and working out the solutions to staff problems. You know, you've got six ships operating in this area and you must fuel each of them once every 3 days, and you must always have two on patrol. How do you arrange their programs? That sort of thing. Or write an appreciation of the problem about a certain aspect of naval activity. It was also, of course, a great time of privilege being near London, dining in the Painted Hall, and when occasionally I get invitations from various charities to say, if you like to pay us £100, you can dine in the Painted Hall. I am very tempted to write back and saying, for 6 months of my life, I had to explain to the commander in writing why I wasn't dining in the Painted Hall. So it's, but it was an opportunity. It was the nearest equivalent we got at that time to being at university. And, of course, London was there. I was very interested in the theatre, and there was the opportunity to go to the theatre. And I'm afraid on one or two occasions, because we were allowed to book theatre tickets through the hall porter, and they were put on a mess bill. At the end of the month, my mess bill was very nearly the equivalent of my pay. Not an enormous sum, £14.
And then you had your courses at Portsmouth?
Well, then we went to Portsmouth and we spent 6 weeks at Vernon doing anti-submarine and torpedo work, 6 months at Dryad on navigation and action information organisation. A course here at Gosport, at an air station, learning to fly a Tiger Moth and learning about naval aviation. A signals course, amphibious warfare course, damage control, PT, divisional work, and finally gunnery. And our gunnery officer was the then Lieutenant Henry Leach, who later became First Sea Lord and who has remained a close friend ever since. And he always used to refer to me by my nickname. So,
what was your nickname?
My nickname was Scran.
Is that food?
No, in the Navy, the Scran bag is the name given to a collection of lost property, which is found lying about the ship. And I was given this nickname by a petty officer in the Duke of York when I turned up for both watches at 6 o'clock in the morning, having dressed rather hurriedly. And he announced to the world in general that there was a proper Scran bag appearing on the deck. A fellow midshipman heard it, and of course, that was it. There's still about half a dozen people who refer to me as Scran, including, say, and it was rather amusing at meetings in the Ministry of Defence when we were both admirals. At a high-grade meeting, he'd turn around and say, what has Scran got to say about this?
And after your courses?
After the courses, we then had to decide what our specialisation was. Do we want to be a gunnery officer, torpedo navigating officer, signals officer, assault horse, which means you didn't specialise at all, an aviator or a submariner. And I said I wanted to be a submariner. The captain of the gunnery school was responsible for deciding whether people who wanted to be submariners showed the requisite qualities. Why the captain of the gunnery school, I don't know, but he was. Because we didn't do a submarine course during our submarine time.
What were these requisite qualities?
I still don't know. I still don't know. Perhaps a certain disorder in the dress, perhaps. I don't know. But I was recommended. And I joined HMS Dolphin for my submarine training. And my great friend from that time on was John Fieldhouse, who was a Dartmouth cadet, and therefore, when we were in different divisions in the training cruiser and different fleets as midshipmen, but from the time we arrived in Dolphin, we became very close friends. And that was when I think one really started to work seriously towards the development of one's career. Before, we'd been taught things, we'd learnt them, we'd done as well as we could, or perhaps we'd done rather less well than we could. But we were really assimilating background the whole time, and I think it was because it was not particularly structured in some ways. One midshipman's time was a very valuable learning experience, because the sailors taught you a lot, and you were in a position where you were allowed enough responsibility to make mistakes without them being essentially serious mistakes. And it was accepted that you were still under training, but then you were taught at the same time that one had certain responsibilities which one had to exercise. And of course it is by making mistakes that one learns. And far better to make one's mistakes as a midshipman than later on in life. So I don't think it was a bad system of training, though, whether it would meet the tenets of modern management and training practice, I doubt. But as I say, once we got on the submarine course, then a certain amount of dedication and this is my career came into it, and that was very... Very important. I thought it was a good course. A submarine officer, be he an engineer or a seaman, or nowadays a supply officer, has to be aware of practically everything in the submarine. A seaman officer in a ship can have a fairly rudimentary knowledge of the engine room. A seaman officer in a submarine has to have quite a good knowledge of the engine room. And certainly a very good knowledge of all the systems, the hydraulic systems, the high pressure air, the fuel, you name it. So it was a very much a technically orientated course and a very practical course, including a month at sea in a submarine. We then had our final examinations, which I only took the first paper because I was woken up the morning of the second morning of the exams to be told my father was dying, and I was sent on leave. So I never actually passed my submarine training class on paper. But when I came back from having organised the funeral and sorted out my mother's affairs a fortnight later, the then training officer, the Lieutenant Commander Pitt, who was again a very distinguished wartime CO, said he'd spoken to my course officer And as far as he was concerned, I'd done enough to be sent to sea as a sub-lieutenant. So off I went, and eventually, about a month later, I found myself in Londonderry in HMS Thule, again with John Fieldhouse. Then we spent the next year together as the junior officers in the submarine. And I think it was then that we really cemented our friendship. I then had a normal submarine officer's career, I suppose. From time immemorial, the junior officers in a submarine have been called the third and fourth hands. You had the captain, the first lieutenant, and the third and fourth hands. One of the junior officers would be responsible for navigation and signals, and another one responsible for the torpedoes and the upper deck work. And one did this in the course of one's time. One did the whole of the work. I then became a first lieutenant in HMS Turpin and later HMS Thermopylae. I then became the officer's training officer at HMS Dolphin. And then was appointed to the commanding officer's qualifying course, which we call the Perisher. And this consisted of 6 weeks shore training at Dolphin and 6 weeks at sea in a submarine carrying out attacks. On successfully passing this course, one was qualified for command.
What did you think of the Perisher course?
It was a hard course, there's no doubt about it. And of course it was a course on which our future career in submarines depended. So to say one was completely relaxed during it was wrong. But our Perisher was a very cohesive team, and I think the fact that we provided each other with a lot of mutual support. We had one officer who was very worried, and I think that helped the rest of us because we all felt we must support him. And we all actually passed the course, which was quite unusual. The normal failure rate is about 1 in 5. I then went to my first command, which was a small S-boat, S-class submarine, crew of about 35, and had a very happy year.
Was this called Sea Scout?
Sea Scout, yes. A very happy year in Sea Scout, and I think I was fortunate enough to be considered that I was worth future employment in submarines. I then spent a fascinating 2 years at Portland at the Underwater Detection Establishment, providing practical submarine advice on the design and development of new sonar equipment. And then had my second command. By this time it was 1959. My second command was HMS Artful, A-class diesel submarine, which again I had until 1961, when I was appointed to the submarine attack teacher in Rothsay in the Isle of Bute. This establishment had been built during the war to train submarine COs and attack teams. And the Clyde, of course, was the main submarine UK base during the war. And it continued to operate this attack teacher for some years afterwards. And that was a very good job in very fine, very pleasant surroundings. And we used to have to work hard when we worked, when there was a course there, but when there wasn't a course, we could work flexi hours. I took up a bit of fishing, some people took up golf, but we also were responsible for the development of submarine attack tactics and doctrine. So it was a very worthwhile job professionally. And one met practically every submarine officer coming through at one time or another during that time, either as a member of the crew, or as an officer under training, or as an officer undergoing his command course. I also, during this time, went to America and had my first seagoing in an American nuclear submarine during an exercise. Yes, I went on this American nuclear submarine for an exercise, and it was, of course, it opened up a new dimension. And by that time, Britain, of course, had already built HMS Dreadnought, though I hadn't been one of the first people selected to be a nuclear submarine officer. But this was a very, I think, valuable experience. And I was fortunate to be quite early to ride an American submarine like that.
So this is the 1960s?
This was 1960, early 1963. I was promoted at the end of 1963, and I became the flotilla operations officer to Flag Officer Submarines for 2 years. The admirals at the time were Horace Law, who was not a submarine, he was a gunnery officer, but he was a very, very good Flag Officer Submarines, because I think he had that very valuable attribute of an open mind and an extremely good judgment. And he was succeeded by Admiral Ian McGeoch, who was a submariner, quite a distinguished wartime submariner, and now quite a well-known naval historian. At the end of that 2 years, I was due to go back to general service. I hadn't had an other than a submarine-related job. And I was fortunate enough for my general service job to be in a ship, and I was appointed as the executive officer of HMS Kent, who was about to sail for the, well, was refitting and was due to go to the Far East on the last, as it turned out, about the last of what were the 12-month East of Suez deployments. I had a very understanding captain who I think wondered what he'd done wrong when he had a submariner as his commander, but we got on very well. The ship's company used to call us Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble, which I don't know whether it was for any reason, but they did.
Which one were you?
I was Barney. See, I was the little one. Captain Begg was the great big one. And we spent a year away from the UK, mostly on the Far East station, Singapore, Hong Kong, revisited Japan after many years to see a lot of differences, Australia, and our return passage home, instead of coming up through Suez and the Mediterranean, George Brown, who was the then Foreign Secretary, was desperately working to keep South Africa within the Commonwealth. And so HMS Kent and two other ships were sent to Cape Town on a goodwill visit, where we were extremely well treated. It was very interesting because ashore we were strictly bound by the apartheid rules. On board, we would not observe apartheid rules. And I found myself one day, as guests of the then ruling party, the National Party, being given a tour of the Parliament building, and the next day entertaining for lunch on board a group of what they call the Cape Coloureds. It was the Association of Cape Coloured Ex-Servicemen who'd fought for the British forces during the war. And we had this funny thing. On board, we were colourblind. Ashore, we were not allowed to be. I suppose insofar as one had time to think about it, one was struck the contrast between our hosts, who tended to be South Africans of British descent, occasionally of Boer descent, who were kindness itself, and the general atmosphere, where I certainly got the impression from seeing the black people in the streets, they were undoubtedly a subservient, downtrodden people, not like the coloured people in Singapore our efforts to helped George Brown failed. He sent the captain a nice signal, but we then went over to Tristan da Cunha, where I had the glorious sight of seeing a British colonial governor, complete with ostrich feather hat, stepping out of a helicopter to call on the captain. And Montevideo, Buenos Aires, and Rio de Janeiro. Of course, three very different South American countries. I mean, Uruguay, poor. Argentina, rich. Both very pro-British. I was a lunch I went to in Buenos Aires as the guests of what they called the Pickwick Club, and I asked what the Pickwick Club was, and they said, "Oh, these are Argentinians who hold a degree from either Oxford or Cambridge." And there was a picture of Mr. Pickwick. I don't know why they chose Mr. Pickwick, but there he was on the table. And they looked after us extremely well. We had a Royal Marine band embarked for the occasion, and after our cocktail parties they used to beat retreat. And I can always remember the expatriates who we had on board for the cocktail party getting very moist-eyed as the Royal Marine band played Sunset and things like that. It was very good. One could never have dreamt that, you know, 15, 16 years later, I was going to be involved in a war against these people. I say Uruguay was a much poorer country. I've never seen so many old countries.